Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 30th of October. For those of us who have loved ones on the East Coast, and I would think that that may include most of our audience, it was a huge area affected by that incredible storm yesterday. I hope everyone is well today, and I'm sure you stayed up late as we did checking on the storm and the damage, and it was just awful. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking with Ira Shapiro. Ira is an interesting person. He has a long career working with the Senate. He came to work as a summer intern for Senator Jacob Javits, the liberal Republican from New York, in 1969. He was Gaylord Nelson's legislative legal counsel, worked in the Senate for a number of years. When Ronald Reagan won the landslide victory to become president, Ira became minority staff director and chief counsel of the Governmental Affairs Committee. He was an early supporter of Bill Clinton. He helped Bill Clinton select his vice presidential running mate, and he has written a book about the Senate. It is titled The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. The author says in recent history, the greatest Senates were found in the years from the 1960s to the 1980s. Why was that? What has changed? Will there be another great Senate down the road sometime? We'll talk about all of that this hour. For you to join our conversation, our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Ira Shapiro, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much.
And you usually, I would imagine, live in Washington, but you're not in Washington now.
No, I had to be. I was committed to California before the storm, and we've been checking back and very anxious about our families there.
What does, as we talk about courage and statesmanship in a time of crisis, it's just, what a time. We're so close to a presidential election. Some people are playing politics with this. What does it take to really address this particular crisis with courage and statesmanship?
Well, I think that one reason I wrote the book, Kathleen, was several years ago, I noticed that the Senate, which I had loved when I worked there, had become virtually unrecognizable to me, polarized, paralyzed, and dysfunctional, completely lacking in courage and statesmanship. Sort of the greatest legislative body in the world had become what has been described as the empty chamber. So I wanted to write a book that showed how it worked in the 60s and the 70s, when we actually had senators and a Senate that were focused on the national interest. I guess two things that I focus on are, number one, those senators and that Senate were primarily interested in the national interest. They weren't partisan operatives, basically. They weren't involved in a permanent campaign. And that's what contrasts them primarily from the group that we've had in the Senate now for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. You say that, and I think this is interesting, perhaps one of the reasons that there has been a change is that people who were familiar with and perhaps fought in World War II were in the Senate in the 60s up till the 80s, and then they weren't anymore, and they had a different idea of government.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation doesn't need any postscript or footnotes from me. But the fact is, the men, and at that point they were almost exclusively men, who came back from World War II, who went into the Senate later, they had a sense of shared common purpose. They believed in government and they had faith in politics. They had seen our country's strength and they wanted, many of them wanted to rectify its weaknesses, including the historical injustice about racial discrimination. And the truth is, if you had been in the Normandy invasion, you actually didn't think that casting a hard vote every now and again was that tough.
And those people are no longer in the Senate.
No, they're long gone. But the truth is, Kathleen, they mentored others.
Mm-hmm.
The people who served in the Senate in the 60s and the 70s, and Wisconsin had two of the great senators in Gaylord Nelson and Bill Proxmire. Those people, they were an example for those that came later, and they kind of inspired them as to what you had to do to be a senator. And they also, frankly, inspired many of us who were at the staff level. I didn't know all these people, but if you went through the 60s and the 70s in the Senate, at the staff level, you found people like Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Steve Breyer, Tim Russert, future Senators Daschle, Alexander, Collins. There were just a lot of people who learned how to be in politics and government, to do things that were principled, to compromise, to make things happen.
You worked for Gaylord Nelson, didn't you?
I did. And Gaylord Nelson was one of the great people and great senators of his time. And also, I once wrote that Nelson was actually the first true environmentalist. And somebody might dispute that. But the fact is, Gaylord Nelson was a tremendous conservationist and a leading governor of Wisconsin. Several years before Rachel Carson's great book, The Silent Spring, we tend to view the environmental movement as starting with Rachel Carson and her book that raised consciousness. But Gaylord was there before that.
Mm-hmm. Things changed when Ronald Reagan was elected. Is that a fair point of a time, a characterization of the time in history when things changed?
Yes, it is a break point. What I describe as the Great Senate, the Senate of Nelson and Proxmire, Hubert Humphrey, Jacob Javits, Howard Baker, Ted Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Bob Dole, I describe it as the 60s and the 70s ending with the 1980 election. Reagan's landslide swept out a lot of great legislators, including George McGovern and Birch Bayh and Gaylord Nelson. But the story wasn't done yet. Even though the Senate turned Republican, there were still a lot of good senators there. And by the mid-80s, it was functioning again the way the Senate actually should. Then in the 90s, things started going down, and they have continued going down, almost in a downward spiral. And I do attribute that primarily to Newt Gingrich and his Senate friends.
Would it be, we have heard this characterization of the Senate now being the most partisan Senate in the history of that body. Is that going too far?
Well, I think that it's probably the most partisan Senate in the history of the country. It's certainly the most partisan Senate in this century. As measured by party line votes and by number of filibusters. I think that's true. And I think that it's unfortunate for a whole lot of reasons, but one is there are actually quite a few competent people up there in the Senate now. But it's difficult to be a really great senator without a workable Senate. And they don't have one.
You have written that much of today's gridlock stems from the Republican Party in the aftermath of the 2008 presidential election. The president was facing the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression and two wars. And the Senate's priority, you write, was to make sure Obama wasn't reelected. That should not have been their priority. It should have been the national interest.
Well, I feel strongly about that, Kate. And I have to say, I wear two hats. Because of the book, I'm a political historian focusing on the Senate. I'm also a partisan Democrat, so I have to acknowledge that. But if you look at what happened after Obama was elected, we're in the midst of a national economic crisis, the worst in 80 years. He wins a clear and emphatic victory. He believed, and I think he was right to believe, the story that we come together in times of crisis. And that simply didn't happen. It was the basic goal of the Senate Republicans to not cooperate, to defeat Obama. And Mitch McConnell has said as much. That was his highest priority. So I consider that to be a real departure from the way the Senate is supposed to work, and a real departure from basic patriotic behavior.
Can it also be explained as just completely different philosophical ideas, different sets of values that are bound to clash?
Well, I think there is certainly some of that, Kate. We have a situation where the Republican Party has moved substantially and repeatedly to the right. So there are very few people that we would call, by historical standards, moderates in the Republican Party in the Senate. But I don't think that's all of it. I actually think that some of it is a strategic judgment that obstruction and opposing Obama was the fastest way to bring about a more Republican Congress and ultimately to try to deny him re-election. And I have to say, this tactic, we saw this tactic before when Bill Clinton was elected president. He had very little, if any, cooperation from the Republicans. And that's not the way the Senate used to work. And frankly, it's not the way the Senate worked when George W. Bush was elected. He was given the chance to accomplish some things, and people worked with him.
So what does it take to bring back a desire to serve in the national interest?
Well, I think that if I have any optimism, and it's easier to be pessimistic than optimistic given the vitriolic political culture we have. But if I have optimism, it's based on the fact that I think much of the public is disgusted with the way the Congress and particularly the Senate have failed to work. So if obstruction and paralysis was a good strategy, perhaps Congress would have more than a 10% approval rating. I also think that many of the people in the Senate on both sides are capable people, and they're as angry and frustrated about being in a paralyzed institution as the public is. Not all of them. Some of them clearly want to be instruments of obstruction. But many of them think they were actually sent to Washington to work on the nation's problems. And I'm hopeful that they will find a way to do so after this election.
You would think, wouldn't you? You've worked with these people, that they would be slightly embarrassed that their approval rating is so low, or do they just not pay attention to that?
Oh, no, I think they are embarrassed. I mean, somebody said to me, and I'm speaking mostly about the Senate because that's what I've written about and worked on more, but somebody said to me recently, the current Senate must really dislike your book, because you talk so glowingly about the Senate of the past and you clearly don't think much of their Senate today. And I said, no, they all seem to agree. They don't think much of their Senate today.
Ira Shapiro is our guest this hour. His book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. It reflects his work with and passion for the Senate going back more than 40 years. To join our conversation, 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll start taking your calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, a lot of people have said this election will all come down to Ohio. So we thought we would talk with people in Ohio covering this race very carefully. We'll have a reporter at Ohio Public Radio and Television with us, and we'll speak with an associate professor of political science at the University of Akron, co-author of Buckeye Battleground, Ohio Campaigns and Elections in the 21st Century. Ira Shapiro this hour, his book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, and we will start our calls with Darren in Viroqua. Hi, Darren.
Hi, good morning. I remember the days of Ted Kennedy, and I miss Senator Kennedy. I remember also the 1980 election when George McGovern and Birch Bayh, others were swept out of office, as your guest made reference to. I also remember Mitch McConnell right away, first African-American president is elected, and Mitch McConnell, from a relatively southern state, comes out and says, we're going to make this a one-term president. You know, we turned out a great legal mind here in Wisconsin, Russ Feingold, and elected Ron Johnson. That's just another indication. I agree 100% with Ira Shapiro that we are in a downward spiral. I mean, we had a senator who produced legislation, a great legal mind who's now a scholar at Marquette. What has Ron Johnson done? He goes around and gives speeches for Americans for Prosperity and groups like that. He's done nothing. And so my point is, I miss Ted Kennedy. I miss Paul Wellstone. I worked on Paul Wellstone's first campaign when I lived in Minnesota. I miss Russ Feingold.
Do you miss any Republicans?
Yes. I'm trying to think of some moderate Republicans. I'm pulling a Tommy Thompson moment here. Where
Ira.
As a strong Democrat, I agree with the caller on much of this, but I also miss a number of the Republicans. I once said that the difference between the Senate when Howard Baker was the Republican leader, Howard Baker of Tennessee, and Mitch McConnell is like the Grand Canyon. Baker epitomized the courage and statesmanship that senators are supposed to have. He supported President Carter in the very difficult fight over a new Panama Canal treaty when much of his party was completely against it, and it was really driving Ronald Reagan's campaign. But Baker said, it's in the national interest. I'll support it even if it means I can't run for president successfully. There were Republican moderates, and there were Republican, even conservatives, who believed that the Senate should be able to work. And that's what we're missing today.
Let's go to George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I think that the Republicans have a much easier time being obstructionists and causing gridlock, because they fundamentally don't really want federal government to be seen as being very successful in just about anything they do. Whereas the Democrats, as your guest alluded to after George W. Bush was elected, did try to work with him at first, even though he was pushing a very right agenda right from the get-go, even before 9/11. Yet the Democrats were willing to do some things that they felt were in the national interest. I think this is a big difference, and it gives Republicans somewhat of an advantage.
I absolutely agree with the caller. We have a government that our framers set up that makes it difficult to accomplish things. Power is divided and separated in ways that show a skepticism of government. It has in history required sort of a progressive impulse to overcome that. And that was the progressiveness of the great Senate that I wrote about. That period of the 60s and the 70s was a progressive era in the Senate. And you needed that to overcome the inertia in our system. So certainly, it's easier to be an obstructionist. And if you don't have a positive agenda and you're opposed to government, what bothers me about some of the people up there is that I think they've just become partisan, even though when there was a Republican president, they tended to support certain things. John McCain is one example of somebody who has changed his position on things after the 2008 election.
Well, let's look at an issue that's been front and center in this particular campaign, and that's health care. The Republicans have used as part of their talking point a repeal of what they call and what everybody calls Obamacare now. And part of their line is that the president rammed this through without consultation with Republicans who could help fashion a bill here, that they were the ones who were heavily partisan and obstructionist.
Well, that is their line. And certainly I believe that there are things that President Obama could have done somewhat differently. There's an argument that he overcompensated for Bill Clinton's experience. The Clinton administration did their health care kind of behind closed doors and without the Hill. Obama dealt pretty heavily with the Hill Democrats, and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid worked on the health care. But the truth of the matter is, it wouldn't have been difficult for some Republicans to say, health care, we're the only country, advanced country in the world without health care for all people. Presidents have been thinking about doing this for 60 years, and there are Democratic ideas and Republican ideas that are part of what Obama is proposing. The individual mandate was a Republican idea. It came from the Heritage Foundation. People could have come together behind that proposal, but they had no interest in doing it. When Olympia Snow, for instance, was working on health care, she got a pretty strong message from the leadership: we're not interested in working this out. So things could have been done better, but there was a real partisan impulse to defeat health care and demonize it.
Thanks, George, for your call. Linda in Ripon. Hi, Linda.
Yes, given these issues, I was wondering if your guest had any glimpses into some of the background that might be racist, where we've got a one-term president because there's some people that are still very afraid of a black man in the White House. I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you, Linda.
Well, certainly people think about that possibility, and we discuss, my wife and I have discussed that question, and we talk about it, but I'm inclined to believe that, having watched the Clinton experience, that the partisan divide is not a racial, not particularly racially motivated. I mean, the Republicans tried to destroy Bill Clinton, and they've tried as best they can to defeat Obama. The truth is, they have a profound sense of grievance and seemingly an unwillingness at this point to accept being out of power. They had the White House 12 years in a row before Bill Clinton, and they had 8 years before Barack Obama. They have difficulty accepting the results of elections that they don't win.
So what do you think it takes? Some huge issue where partisanship, I mean, could it be the health care issue? Is it some unknown issue where this lack of working together in the national interest creates a huge, huge problem for this country, and then everybody wakes up? I don't know what changes this.
Well, somebody said to me, this won't change until we have a real crisis. And I said, well, in the last 15 years, we've had one crisis after another. We had the impeachment of a president. We had 9/11. We had the financial crisis. We had two wars. I'm not sure how many more crises we can stand. I mean, from my standpoint, and the reason I focus on the Senate a little bit, is that there are people there that know what they're supposed to be doing and could change the tenor of our politics relatively easily compared to other things. And the reason I say that is that if you go back 2 years to the lame duck session of 2010, a lot got done just because eight Republican senators opposed their leader on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, treatment of gays and lesbians in the military. That passed legislatively. 13 Republicans broke with their leader on the START nuclear arms control treaty. you can change things if people are willing to go back to exercising some independent judgment and not handing their votes at the door to their party leaders.
Warren in Richland Center is next. Hi, Warren.
Hi, Kev. I listened to Mr. Shapiro, and he accuses the Republicans, particularly the Congress. As far as I know, in the last 4 years, the Congress on the Senate side has been totally in the Democrats' hands. They've not did a budget in the 4 years, which I can't even believe would be possible. Health care was passed without one Republican, and Obama had to buy off about three senators to do that. The cost of health care now for Obamacare has went from $1 trillion to $2 trillion because they fudged the numbers. So for him to blame the Republicans when Obama's had a clean slate in the Senate is just beyond me.
Ira.
Well, the reason I, in response to the caller, the reason I do blame the Republicans is because the way the Senate has traditionally worked, it's what Walter Mondale once called our sort of national mediator. That was the place where the Democrats and the Republicans came together to bridge ideological differences, to bridge regional differences, to really hammer out principled compromises. The Senate has never worked with one party doing everything alone. So I understand your statement that President Obama had 60 Democrats and sort of got the health care through without any Republicans. But my view, and having watched it closely, is he did it that way because there were no Republicans that were willing to cooperate on it. They were involved in what was called the Gang of Six. Several of the Republicans worked hard for a while with Democrats. And ultimately, the conclusion was, we don't want any part of this. We're going to just oppose it. There is no compromise. And so I guess what I'm referring to is the way that his Senate has historically worked, as opposed to what I saw the last few years.
Was Medicare as difficult as the current health care legislation?
Well, Medicare actually... You're too good, Kathleen, because you did go back to the one time when the Democrats had even more members of Congress and the Senate,
mm-hmm.
and did much of it by them. You know, they took the lead on it, but they weren't alone. Medicare was difficult, and it was a historic legislative undertaking, and the Republican Party regarded it as a socialist undertaking for the most part. But there were some Republicans who cooperated with it. If you look at, take that in that same time period, give you an example, the civil rights legislation, 1964, the historic civil rights legislation, 27 out of 33 Senate Republicans supported the civil rights legislation. Barry Goldwater, their party nominee that summer, opposed it. But he was only one of six who opposed it. It was a bipartisan undertaking, brought up, made successful by Everett Dirksen, the minority leader. That's the way the Senate used to work.
It's just amazing to me, Ira, you know this so well, having worked with the Senate for so many years. You take an issue like health care, where people for years and years, business people and people who can't get insurance and people who are paying too much for insurance and kids who aren't insured, et cetera, and a growing number of people who aren't insured. On so many levels, this is just a human issue. It's just an issue where people need some kind of relief. Businesses need relief when it comes to premiums, et cetera. And yet, nobody will take this on. It's this huge political battle, and we seem to be forgetting about the fact that people are hurting as a result of a system that really needs some changes. Why, in this issue particularly, has it been so darn difficult to get anything substantial passed since Medicare, when the problems affect so many people?
Well, look, I think it is undeniably, as Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton found out, it's an extraordinarily complex issue. It touches virtually everybody in the country, and it touches about a sixth of the economy. So it is a difficult and complex issue. But I think that the absence of a good faith effort to try to work something out was the real problem. And I have to say, I believe President Obama deserves great credit for persevering and getting the Affordable Care Act through. And look, the measure of the importance of the health care legislation is the fact that it was Governor Romney's greatest accomplishment as a governor. I mean, that's his single signal accomplishment in Massachusetts was health care. He knew it was important. He worked on it. He's been against Obamacare because it's a political matter. So there was a time in which the word went around in Washington that, you know, to get the health care legislation done, one or two Republicans would be willing to work on it if they could find 10 who were willing to do it. 10 Republicans out of, you know, 40. They couldn't find 10. And ultimately, party discipline prevailed and they found nobody.
Here's an email that's come in for you. Mr. Shapiro, what are your thoughts about Harry Reid as head of the Senate right now?
I think Senator Reid deserves respect and sympathy for working as hard as he does to try to work a legislative agenda against implacable opposition. But I don't think individually, you know, he has the stature that some of the past leaders have had. And I think that he and McConnell certainly have not made the Senate work. I think the Senate would benefit from having other leaders. And I could think of a lot of pairs of senators who could make it work better.
Don't you think the Senate might work better if it didn't have so many millionaires?
I think it would be better for the country if there was a broader cross-section of people who actually got into office. Yes, I think there are too many very wealthy people in politics. And I also think that the cost of campaigns, and I speak around the country about my book and these issues, and one of the things that people are extraordinarily despondent about and angry about is a campaign finance system that's completely out of control now. It was out of control before, and since the Citizens United case, it's far worse.
Somebody's making a whole lot of money. Who is it? Are the TV and radio executives for commercial stations pulling in a lot of dough here, or what? Because these are just incredibly expensive races.
I think the political consulting industry makes quite a bit of money, but I also do think that the TV stations, this is a huge source of income for them.
Mm-hmm.
And when we've talked in the past about public financing of campaigns and other kinds of solutions, free TV, for instance, et cetera, from licensees of the government, the response of the networks, the TV stations, has been very negative because they're afraid of losing the money.
Right. Ira Shapiro is our guest this hour. His book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. He is now an international trade lawyer in Washington. He has held senior staff positions in the U.S. Senate and served as general counsel and ambassador in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative during the Clinton administration. Came to work as a summer intern for Senator Jacob Javits from New York in 1969. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where I want to remind you that yesterday we did this great show on the best political movies, so you can watch them prior to the election, if you need to, well, I guess our minds have been on the horrendous storm and not a lot of political news, but we hope that the storm will be cleaned up. And if you need something over the weekend to take your mind to another time, the listing of all the films, plus your suggestions, everybody really got into this, is on our Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our show, is it all going to come down to Ohio? A lot of people think so. And we will talk about Ohio. There are various regions in Ohio that you have to campaign to in different ways. Issues that are different in different parts of the state. Some parts of the state are very conservative. Others are not as conservative. And, of course, the candidates have been camping out there for a long time now. So we will talk about the issues and whether or not they're different from other parts of the country. We'll have two guests with us and look at Ohio Hour 2. 800-486-8655 for you to join this conversation with Ira Shapiro. And let's go next to Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen, and good morning to your guest. Mitch McConnell is not the only Republican who is working against Obama. There was a meeting with Mitch McConnell and Newt Gingrich and Paul Ryan and a bunch of other Republicans the night of Obama's inauguration. They had a dinner where they worked out a strategy to make Obama a one-term president and oppose everything he wanted to do. I think there's a book written about it. I have not heard them deny it, even though it's been brought up a couple of times. And I'm wondering, it almost sounds treasonous.
Well, look, I think from my standpoint, as I said, it's not the way our system's supposed to work. Traditionally, we had campaigns that were often intense campaigns, and then the campaigns ended, and the business of governing went on. I remember when George H.W. Bush, ran the very harsh campaign against Mike Dukakis. And the day after he was elected, it was done. You know, he was reaching out to Democrats and saying, look, campaign's over. Now we've got to get about governing. This has been a change. And as I indicated, I think we first saw it in 1992 and 3 when Bill Clinton was elected, that kind of opposition. But I think it was even worse and indeed, you know, unpatriotic at a time of national economic crisis to be talking about how we're going to oppose the newly elected president, how we're going to try to stop everything he's doing. Just, it's not the way our system's supposed to work.
Now, granted, you are a Democrat, Ira, but I'd like for you to play out both of these scenarios. One is what happens if this is a one-term presidency, and one if it's a two-term presidency. What do you see happening?
Well, I think, you know, if President Obama is reelected, I think there will be significant pressure on the Republicans to be more cooperative. There'll be some that'll want to simply oppose again for four more years. But I think Obama's reelection will give him considerably more leverage. And the upcoming fiscal cliff, as it's referred to, will force some serious compromises. I think if Governor Romney is elected, the Democrats are going to have to consider, you know, whether they can overcome the kind of natural impulse to engage in payback. You know, there will be some that will say, we'll give him about as much cooperation as basically the Republicans gave Obama. But I think generally the Democrats tend to be considerably more constructive. I don't buy the argument that some people make that, you know, both parties have moved toward their extreme wings. I don't think there's any evidence to show that the Democrats have moved left in the same way that the Republicans have moved right.
Marie in Bayview. Hi.
Hello. The scenario of Mitt Romney becoming our president with so many Republicans in the House. Hopefully there'll be less. And with the possibility of the Senate turning over to the Republicans is very scary to me, because it seems like if this goes on, they're convincing more and more of the country that government isn't working for them, and these people just seem to vote against their own interests all the time. And I'm frightened by the fact that if this goes on too long, that they're going to clear away the whole New Deal.
Ira.
Well, I think it is a very frightening prospect. And I think that one of the things that has to happen is that the Democrats and independents and the remaining moderate Republicans will stand against some of those extreme measures. I mean, it's one thing to talk. Look, the truth is, as we've seen from Romney, he ran very, very hard to the right to get the nomination. And he's been engaged in the etch-a-sketch strategy since then to sort of present himself as a more centrist person, trying to let people remember that as a governor, he wasn't an extreme right-wing Republican. So we'll have to see what happens. If he becomes president, he'll have to deal with his own right wing. And, you know, I'm not sure that he would necessarily be strong enough to fight them on everything, but I'm sure that he will fight them on some things. And he'll end up turning to the Democrats and saying, well, we've got to do some things together. But, look, I think the trajectory of our politics is as troubling as the caller has suggested. And one reason I wrote the book, two reasons I wrote the book, but one reason was I wrote the book to show my children that we had a government that used to work. A lot of my audiences are people my age, you know, 60-odd people, who remember the great senators and like reading about the way things were and remembering those people. But the younger people need to know that we used to have a government and it actually did work.
Thanks very much for the call. What's your assessment of the election in the Senate? Polls are indicating that the Senate probably will not go Republican. Do you agree with that assessment?
It appears that the Republicans have a difficult road to win the Senate now, which was not what we all thought originally, because the Democrats had to defend 23 seats and the Republicans only had to defend 10. But it looks like the Democrats will be able to hold on narrowly in all likelihood. But frankly, there are still 10 races that are too close to call, including, course, the intense contest in Wisconsin, which has been very, very close from everything I can read.
And very, very expensive.
And very negative. There was
right.
An article in the paper that I noted recently that in a negative year of campaigning, no race has had more negative ads than the Wisconsin race.
Right. Tim and Ladysmith is next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I simply have to completely disagree with your guest. I know as a Democrat, he sees the world through different eyes. As a conservative, I definitely see the Democratic Party. This is not the same Democratic Party of John F. Kennedy. It is far, far, far left. The idea that somehow this Republicans have obstructed this president is just good political fodder. I mean, he had a supermajority for 2 years. What did they stop? Well, I think they've been able to stop is his recent jobs bill. He's pretty much gotten everything he's wanted, and when the Congress opposed him, he would just go around them by executive order. Now, Americans have a very short memory. I remember when George W. Bush was in the White House, and the Democrat-controlled Congress, the Democrats opposed every nomination of judges he had. So I think the whole idea that somehow the Republicans are obstructionists is just totally nonsense.
And when you say, Tim, that that the Democratic Party is more left, how is it left? How do you see that?
Well, first of all, they're the champions of abortion. They're the champions of gay rights. A lot of their legislation, frankly, I think this particular health care bill, which most Americans oppose, is very socialistic. It's far too reaching. I think Republicans would have gone with it if it would have been a little more moderate, but it's not moderate. It's radical, and most Americans see it as radical. It's not. It's a bad piece of legislation that should have never been brought to the floor.
All right, Ira.
Well, I guess I do disagree with the caller on a number of things. I remember George W. Bush's presidency, and frankly, he took office after an extraordinary set of circumstances, and yet within the very first months that he was there, he got significant cooperation from the Democrats that made the Bush tax cuts possible, and his signature domestic initiative, No Child Left Behind. He got the help of Ted Kennedy. He got the help of George Miller in the House. So he got quite a bit of cooperation in his early months. The Democrats confirmed many more of his nominees than the Republicans have confirmed of Obama's, executive branch and judicial branch. They confirmed Justices Roberts and Alito, even though they were quite a bit more conservative than the Democrats in the Senate. So I don't actually think that his recollection is accurate. But the other thing I would say is, it is true that President Obama got some things through without any Republican support. But that wasn't his preferred course, and that's not the way the country and the government are supposed to operate. So the Republicans, in my view, took the view that they would not cooperate, they would rather oppose, and that basically they would prefer to run against his legislation than make it better.
Thanks, Tim, so much for your call. And let's go to Mary, running short on time, everybody, from Slinger. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
I have a question. Do you think that the Republicans are running more on the Friedman economic plan? Because I read The Shock Doctrine, and it's more about capitalism and not about the little lower and middle class and taking advantage of wars and, you know, making a lot of money.
Well, I think if you look around the world, what you see, all the advanced economies are struggling with some of the same questions. How to get economic growth on the one hand, but control deficits and debt on the other hand. There's something about technology and globalization, I think, that do foster inequality and make people at the top end wealthier. We've seen that in virtually every country. But in most countries, public policy tries to lean against that. Here in the United States, our public policy, and particularly the tax cuts, have fostered even further inequality. And I think that's one of the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans, is that they would favor tax cuts that further the inequities in our society.
Ira Shapiro, thank you, Ira, so much for being with us. It was a lively conversation.
It's wonderful to be on Wisconsin Public Radio and to have such a good amount of time to discuss these issues. Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Sure, our pleasure. Ira Shapiro, he is author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Former general counsel and ambassador in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative during the Clinton administration, and started his work with people in the Senate way back in 1969. We thank him for his time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. We're going to continue our conversation on politics. We're well aware of the huge storm, Hurricane Megastorm Sandy, and how it has affected people and how it may affect votes as well. So we will include that as part of our conversation as we talk about Ohio, the second hour of our show.